Hello, everyone. This is Bob Zeta, the amateur radio call sign is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. Let's read together CQ Magazine in digest format for December 2010 here on the Courage Handy Ham System. CQ Magazine is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 Newbridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. The editor is Richard S. Mawson. Call W2VU. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may be reached at area 763-520-0512 or at email address, in lowercase, handyham@courage.org. Our website is www.handyham.org. Let's begin today with Zero Bias, a CQ editorial by the editor Richard Mawson, W2VU. It's titled The Future of Ham Home Brewing. Building. It's a time-honored ham tradition that many of us fear is endangered. Microprocessors and surface mount technology make it difficult to build radios that even begin to approach the size and the capabilities of commercially available gear. Today's newer hams, it seems to many, have neither the skills for building equipment nor the interest in learning them. We're becoming a hobby of appliance operators. Many old-timers, and some not-so-old-timers, say. Phil Anderson called W0XI, a pioneer in popularizing packet radio in the 1980s, notes in a recent letter praising our articles on using JT65A on high frequency that he's been running an informal survey on the number of schematics and equations showing up in QST, CQ, and in the hobby letters. The trend has been a declining one over the last few decades, he reports. And yet, old-timers have been complaining since probably the 1930s, when commercially built radios first became available, that newcomers are all a bunch of appliance operators. In truth, the majority of hams have always been appliance operators to the extent possible. If they weren't, the commercial ham radio equipment industry would never have gotten off the ground to begin with. Yet, hams adept at programming are growing in numbers, and user programming processors such as PICs or Arduino-based projects make it possible for ham builders to develop their own applications or build projects based on other hams' programming. In fact, the ARRL has put out a ham-focused PIC programming kit and just released a revised version of its PIC Programming for Beginners book to match up the kit and the book. And we will be digging deeper into Arduino in the coming issues. Incidentally, folks, that Arduino is spelled A-R-D-U-I-N-O. Yet, the QRP folks are designing and building kits at a record pace. The hams at AmpSat are continuing to build amateur satellites and the radio gear that travels inside them. And our digital gurus are developing both hardware and software for high-speed RF computer networking that rivals what the commercial folks are doing. Yet, there is a new generation of builders, both inside and outside of ham radio, who prefer the challenge of building their own stuff to just turning on and using something and replacing it when the batteries won't take a charge anymore. Building is a theme that runs through many of the articles in this issue, from our look at the World Maker Fair, held in New York City in September. It's covered both in our lead feature article and in this one's Kids Corner column, to a QRP project, tips on placing parts on the circuit board, that's kit building, and building projects using the Arduino platform, that's digital connection. Digital editor Don Rotolo, called N2IRZ, believes the future of ham radio home brewing lies more in software than in hardware, with hams developing ever more innovative ways to make computer-based radios do new and different things. There is certainly room for experimentation and innovation in this arena, and digital-savvy hams are regularly meeting the challenge. Yet, there is also a lot of hardware being built as well, especially among QR peers and those working where commercial gear doesn't, in the field of amateur satellites, for example. The popularity of our kit-building column also suggests that a good number of hams remain adept with soldering irons as well as keyboards. Also, the enthusiasm for building in the maker community, even among non-hams, suggests that the art of home brewing remains alive and well. It seems to me that the real future of home brewing lies in the junction of hardware and software, and in collaboration between those who design and build the circuitry that supports the efforts of those who write computer code to make that circuitry do what they envision. It also lies in encouraging building and teaching the basics in our radio clubs and at our ham fest. Do you know the Maker Fair had not one but two learn to solder areas, and that they were always packed at a ham fest? Or a learn to read a schematic program at a club meeting? We have an average of 30,000 new people entering the hobby every year right now. Not all of them, a minority most likely, are engineers or electronics experts. Rather than complaining about their lack of skills, we need to encourage and educate them. But we also need to reach out to technically inclined people who haven't yet discovered ham radio and share the excitement of our hobby with them. Is there a maker group in your community? Collaboration with them might be a very good place to start. Now continuing in the Zero Beat updates, Rick Rule, called W4PC, who was featured in last month's cover and wrote the story, A Tale of Two Field Days, about introducing the annual event to prospective hams Destino Cristano and Victoria Harris, tells us that Victoria took her technician exam in mid-October and passed with flying colors. Her call sign hadn't been issued by the time we went to press, but congratulations to Victoria from all of us here at CQ. We close with happy holidays. As we wrap up our 65th anniversary year, as well as the 75th anniversary for the Worked All Zones Award, just 1 month left to qualify for the special WAZ Diamond Jubilee Award, we would like to take a moment to wish each and every one of you a very happy holiday season. May the economy and the sunspots both improve in 2011. 72, Rich, W2VU. Let's take a quick look at the announcements, since it is the month of December. A special event station, amateur called WX3, MAS, Bethlehem and Nazareth, Pennsylvania, Christmas City and Delaware Lehigh Amateur Radio Clubs will operate December 11 and 12 from 1400 Zulu to 0200 Zulu each day for annual Christmas greetings from the twin Christmas cities of Bethlehem and Nazareth, Pennsylvania. The frequencies listed here are throughout the amateur bands. And for a certificate, you can send a QSL information to WX3MAS Greystone Building, Gracedale Complex, RR8, Nazareth, Pennsylvania, 18064. Another special event, a Christmas station, is in Bethlehem, New Mexico. It's actually Belen, B-E-L-E-N, but it's called Bethlehem, New Mexico. There's no call sign given, incidentally. It's on December 18th from 1300 to 2300 Zulu. The operating frequencies, they'll be only on three frequencies, so I'll give those to you, 7.172, 14.272, and 21.372 megahertz. For a QSL card for them, send a self-addressed stamped envelope to VCARA, P.O. Box 268, Peralta, New Mexico, 87042, Peralta, Peralta is spelled P-E-R-A-L-T-A, New Mexico. Now some ham radio news. Generic Satellite comes back to life. While it's not quite as dramatic as the return of Oscar 7 several years back, after two decades of silence, the MSAT News Service reports that signals were heard from Oscar 11 in late August after several months of silence. The satellite launched in 1984, has been operating only sporadically since 2002, and has not been heard at all since the end of March 2010. Observers believe that a component of the satellite may have failed open circuit, easing the drain on its power system. It says it appears to be operating on a schedule of 10 days on, 10 days off, with excellent signal reports from around the world. A downlink-only satellite, its telemetry may be tuned in on the following frequency, 145.826 MHz. A next bit of news, Club gets equipment grant from Pepsi. The Rochester Amateur Radio Club in Rochester, Minnesota has been awarded a grant of more than $2,300 by the local Pepsi distributor as part of the soft drink company's Pepsi Refresh Grants program. According to Newsline, the club will use the money to purchase equipment to better assist in emergency and community communications in downtown Rochester. No specifics were available at press time. Through the Pepsi Refresh Grants program, the company and its distributors planned to donate over $1 million to local community groups. There's a lot more information about that at the following website, www.refresheverything.com. The word refresh everything is one word, www.refresheverything.com. Our next news item, ham sentenced to probation for jamming police. A ham in California, who admitted jamming police and fire frequencies, has been sentenced to 3 years probation in order to undergo psychiatric care. Newsline reports that Irene Levy called KJ6CEY of San Jacinto, California, pleaded guilty in early October to 7 charges arising from unauthorized transmissions on local police and fire frequencies, including at least one bomb threat and interference to communications during several actual emergencies. The Federal Communications Commission has yet to get involved in the case. Based on past cases, it is possible that Levy could face fines, as well as the possible suspension and or revocation of her amateur license. Hams in India called on for help with local election. A group of 20 ham radio operators from the town of Idukki in southern India put their radios and communication skills to use in October in support of local elections. According to the Express News Service of India, there is no regular communication infrastructure in the remote area, so hams were asked to set up stations at all polling places and a district election headquarters. Several of the villages in the region are accessible only by foot. Also in India, the Daily News and Analysis of Mumbai reports that hams in that city became extra eyes and ears for public safety officials during a major Hindu holiday celebration. Members of the Mumbai Amateur Radio Society provided backup communications for police and helped coordinate searches for missing people who get lost in the mind-boggling crowds every year during the Vijayaran, that's an immersion ceremony, that marks the end of the Ganesha Chaturthi holiday. Seems like they may be celebrating a little too hard, folks, huh? With the wrong kind of water, I would suggest. Well, let's take a look at that Maker Faire, that's F-A-I-R-E, a Maker Faire that was just mentioned in the introductory piece. Imagining the World Differently, the World Maker Faire in New York City. The author here is the editor, Rich Mawson, W2VU. The first thing I noticed from the kids, even before I arrived at the first World Maker Faire in New York City on September 25, it was held on the 25th and 26th, I had taken the train and the subway to reach the Hall of Science in Queens, and as I walked a few blocks from the subway station, I found myself amid several families with young children all heading in the same direction. Were they all going where I was? They were. The fair, which advertised itself with an invitation to, quoting, "Come see what happens when we imagine the world differently," close quote, was as heavily focused on family and family-friendly activities as it was on technology and crafts. However, I'm getting ahead of myself. The Maker Faire is a gathering of, well, people who like to make things, people kind of like many of us. I was heading there to see how this fair compared with a typical hamfest, and how the people attending compared with typical attendees at a hamfest. It was quite an eye-opener. There were three things that stood out in my mind. One, the size. Two, the relative youth. And three, activity, activity, activity. Size-wise, the only hamfest to which this Maker Faire can be compared is Dayton. The entire outside area of the Hall of Science, just a little smaller than the Dayton Flea Market, was taken up with 500-plus booths, displays, and demonstrations. There was more inside as well, but not much, because most space is taken up by the museum's permanent displays. Attendance for the two-day event was pegged by the sponsors as more than 25,000. Which is pretty amazing considering that this was a first-time event in the Northeast. Also, it wasn't cheap to attend. Despite the state of the economy, these folks paid admission fees of $25 for adults and either $10 or $15 for kids, depending on the ages, which included admission to the displays at the Hall of Science. There was a senior discount, but only $20. Admission for the family of two adults and two young children was $70, plus the cost of getting there and the cost of food. If you do the math, they probably brought in nearly $500,000 in admission fees alone. The average age appeared to be 30-something, both for attendees and exhibitors. The exhibit seemed to be about 50% electronics-related and 40% craft-related, with the other 10% split among things such as steampunk, which bills itself as Victorian science fiction, rocket-powered cars, and various unidentified but fun-looking contraptions. An interesting facet to the exhibitor side was that the vast majority of display spaces were free for the 530 so-called maker entries who could demonstrate their projects without paying for space. In addition, there were about 50 official exhibitors, such as Make Magazine, that's M-A-K-E Magazine, the overall fair sponsor, Ford Motor Company, and Martha Stewart Living, which did pay to be there, as well as big-name sponsors. Their fees helped make it possible for all of the little guys to be there for free. What really stood out about the exhibits, though, whether large or small, was activity. There was something going on at virtually every table in the place. Things to watch, things to hear, things to do. From watching artist Flint Wessier make magnetic field art, to listening to hams around the world contacting the Hall of Science Amateur Radio Club special event station, to learning to solder at one of two separate areas set up for that purpose. There was also plenty of stuff for kids to do, including an entire Young Makers tent, which displays the activities focused on budding technologists. Hams were represented too. The HOSARC, that's HOSARC, special event station was one of two ham radio displays at the fair. The second was an illustration of the IDOLL, that's spelled IDOLL, mapping program, an APRS overlay developed by the Cadet Amateur Radio Club at the U.S. Military Academy at West Point, New York. In addition, fashion designer, maker, ham, Diana Eng, ENG, call sign KC2UHB, presented a technology fashion show in the newly renovated Great Hall of the Hall of Science. And her Brooklyn Maker Group, New York City Resistor, had a table in the Make Lab area. These were our people out there, although many of them didn't realize it then. They love technology, and they love building. The attitude of most attendees seemed to be wrapped up in one T-shirt I saw, which read, "Don't turn it on, take it apart." Another that caught the eye was, an improvised electronic device is not a crime. Clearly there were more hams among this group, but just as clearly there were not enough. Some groups, such as the NYC Resistor, see the potential in integrating the ham radio and maker cultures, but there needs to be much greater crossover between our groups. Today, there are those among us who feel that the balance in ham radio between communicators and technologists in recent years has been tilting toward the communicators. The technologists are still out there, though. If the 25,000 of them who came together on one weekend in New York City is any indication, we can bring more of them into ham radio, but it's unlikely that they'll come looking for us. We need to meet them on their turf with interesting, useful, hands-on projects and show them how ham radio can be a great outlet for their desire to build things and to imagine the world differently. Being part of a Market Fest is a good first step. I'm moving to the next article, which is results of the 2010 CQ Worldwide DX 160-meter contest. The author here is Andy Blank. Call in to NT. Before I begin the summation, I must say that most of you, if you listen to me on a regular basis, recording the magazine, especially CQ Magazine, which we're doing now, CQ is famous for a lot of different kind of great amateur radio contests that are planned throughout the calendar year. The 160-meter contest is probably the biggest in that category of the spectrum, 160 meters. I'll just give you some of the information because most of it is very, very elaborately presented because it's all about the scores, the plaque donors and winners and so forth. All of that's great if you're really into it and you'd like to know about it. It begins on page 26 of the December 2010 CQ magazine. While the delay of strong activity in sunspot cycle 24 probably makes 10-meter enthusiasts unhappy, the 160-meter crowd certainly won't complain. It was too much to ask for a repeat of the fabulous conditions of the 2009 contest, but the 2010 running of the CQ 160-meter contest was not too far behind. The conditions on CW, that's Morse code, were still pretty darn good, producing 48 million airs versus the 59 from 2009. There were none on single sideband, where conditions were not quite as good, but that is more a function of the activity and inherent noise levels, or QRM, Q sign. Almost no records were broken this time, apart from some smaller local records. Some scores were pretty close to the ones set in 2009, but most were noticeably down. The total logs submitted were up on CW from the year 2009 by 170 to 2390, including check logs. On single sideband, the total was almost identical to 2009, 1,094 versus 1,096. The distribution was very consistent with the category changes from the 2009, indicating most stations tend to gravitate to the same categories. Now, regarding the results on CW, the CW contest seemed to bring out intense competition in many areas. From an examination of the results, it is apparent that stations closer to the higher geographic clusters of activity had a normal advantage, as opposed to the year 2009, when scores were higher all over the world. The U.S. single-op winner, Doug, K1DG, had almost the same score as in 2009, along with fellow main stations K8PO and K1UO, who took three out of four top spots. K3ZM in Virginia filled the fourth spot, and perennial top tenors W4ZV and AA1K were down a bit as conditions seemed to favor the Northeast. The USA multi-op competition is one of the most competitive categories in all of contesting. The four big guns, the WAJI, W2GD, KC1XX, and K1LZ, seem to swap top spots each year. This time it was K1LZ's turn. The gang braved the elements to put a New England coast station on the air. On the world stage, it was another runaway victory in single op for Jim, CN2R. Jim smoked the competition by over 1 meg. Of course, in this contest, being in Africa is a huge advantage, since points are higher outside your continent. The next 6 spots in single op were grabbed by European stations in a tight battle. In single op low power, there was more of a distribution of scores around the world. Lally, called VE3NE, managed to grab the top world score. In QRP, or low power, Milan, OK2BYW, took the top spot in the world with 240,000, edging out HA8BE and OK1FKD in a highly contested category. The article goes on about the very specifics of numerous call signs that won certain categories and positions and such. If you're interested in the very specifics, the article for the results of the 2010 CQLYDX 160-meter contest actually begins on page 26 and runs quite a few pages further up the magazine, including at the very back where they had to finish part of the article. But it's obviously very, very detailed, and if you're into that contesting, you still want to look at it or have someone read it to you. This piece is followed by the announcement of the 2011 CQDX Marathon. The author is John Sweeney, called K9EL. The 2011 edition of the CQDX Marathon begins at zero universal time constant on January 1, 2011, and runs through 23:59 universal time constant on December 31, 2011. The goal, as always, is to work as many countries and CQ zones as possible at least once during the calendar year. There are no changes to the rules this year. Once again, we will use a downloadable Microsoft Excel template or its equivalent, which may be filled in and emailed to a special address as your log entry. Conversion programs are available to automatically populate the template from your logging program. For more information about this, see the DX Marathon website for details. The activity period, of course, is, as I just noted, from January through the very end of December 31, 2011. Now, each year's event is separate. The frequencies are any authorized amateur frequency may be used. Contacts through repeaters or satellites are not allowed for credit, nor are contacts with maritime or aeronautical mobile stations. All contacts must be made entirely over amateur radio frequencies. As a for instance, Echolink type contacts do not count. Now, regarding the modes, any authorized amateur mode may be used. 3 modes will be recognized in the DX Marathon: CW, single sideband, and digital. All modes other than CW and single sideband will count as digital. Submissions with all contacts utilizing a single mode will be recognized. All awards are for single operators only. Entries with 2 or more call signs will only count as a single entry if all contacts were made by the same single operator at the same station using the same antennas. There are 2 entry classes, Formula and Unlimited. Now, regarding the scoring, each country worked is worth 1 point. Each CQ zone worked is worth 1 point. The total score is the sum of zones and countries worked on any mode and any authorized band. There are no multipliers of any kind. Each country and zone count only once. Submission must be made electronically via email to the following: scores@dxmarathon.com. That's S-C-O-R-E-S at, one word, dxmarathon.com. For verification purposes, QSLs are not required. The operator is expected to claim contacts only from stations the operator has every reason to believe are legitimate, and only to claim contacts in which an accurate two-way exchange was clearly accomplished. Clubs are strongly encouraged to use the framework of this contest for intramural and regional competitions. The final listing of official scores will be posted on the DX Marathon website after the annual summary of the winning scores and details is published in CQ magazines. Certificates will be issued to the winners from each CQ zone and each CQ country. Where there is sufficient activity, additional certificates may be issued for other high scorers or for scores using a single mode. In any case, the rulings of the CQDX Marathon Committee and the CQDX Marathon Manager are final. Our next piece is titled Water, Water Everywhere. It's in the category Maths Notes by Irving Math, M-A-T-H, called W-A-2-N-D-M. This month we would like to cover a topic that could be of help to anyone who is unfortunate enough to have dropped an HT, a handy talkie, or a cell phone for that matter, into a puddle, pool of water, or Horus, the ocean. If this is the case, and you happen to have a waterproof unit, there is probably no real problem. For the rest of us, however, there are certain steps you can take to attempt to rescue the unit. Impurities present in common water, and especially in salt water, can cause undesirable currents to flow in high impedance circuits, damaging sensitive microprocessors and CMOS devices. Caustic residue from salt water, chlorinated swimming pool water, or even impurities present in tap water can create poor connections, intermittent switches, or eventually dissolve fine traces on the circuit board. Since each HT is different, the effects of water on each will also be different. Whatever unit you have, however, it is imperative that you dry it out as soon as possible. The following steps are only intended as a guide. Your exact experience and final results will be determined by the unit you have. So let's look at these. 1. Make sure that you rescue the unit from the water as quickly as possible. 2. When you do recover it, be absolutely certain to disconnect the battery as quickly as possible before doing anything else. You do not want any stray current going anywhere it shouldn't. Don't even think of turning it on to see if it still works. It may or may not, but to do so at this point can cause serious, irreparable damage. 3. Next, carefully disassemble the unit down to the point where you fully expose the circuit board on both sides. You may need special tools for this. Be careful of any cables or flexible circuit board traces you encounter, as these can be quite delicate. 4. Now obtain a bottle of triple distilled water, triple if you can get it, from the local pharmacy. Be sure it is as distilled as possible, since you will use this for cleaning purposes. Distilled water, by the way, is not a conductor. Never even consider using alcohol or any other hydrocarbon or cleaning fluid. These can quickly dissolve the various types of adhesives used to hold together some portions of an HT. 5. Carefully rinse both sides of the circuit board and use a clean, sterile Q-tip. Gently remove any residue that you see. If you have the misfortune to drop your handy talkie into salt water, be sure to clean out any remaining salt deposit. Be especially careful around speakers, which may have paper cones and microphones. Also examine the area between the pins of the various integrated circuits for any remaining deposits. A jeweler's loop may come in handy here. 6. Now, using a paper towel, sponge, or something similar, try to remove as much water as possible. Do not attempt to remove it all at this point, as any water that has seeped under any IC probably will not be noticeable. 7. To remove the remaining water will require a desiccant of some sort. An old trick is to place the HT in a plastic bag and cover it with a couple of handfuls of uncooked common rice. If, however, you happen to have some packages of silica gel, sometimes provided with electronic assemblies to eliminate moisture, use these. If not, the rice should do fine. Let the unit stay immersed in the rice for a couple of days. Do not apply heat to it or use any type of heater during this time. 8. After a couple of days, inspect everything to be sure it looks totally dry. If you are not sure, wait a day or two more. And number 9, now for the moment of truth. Carefully reassemble the unit, reconnect the battery, and turn on the power. If you are very lucky, all will be fine. If not, well, at least you tried, and we'll be more careful in the future. While the above steps are oriented toward HTs and other portable units, similar measures can be used for larger equipment. In these cases, the drying period will be longer. If you are the unlucky owner of water-damaged equipment, you should at least try some of the methods mentioned. Often you will be lucky and be able to restore the equipment to full working order. I sincerely hope the above is helpful to many of you out there. At this time, I would like to take the opportunity to wish you all a very happy and healthy holiday season. I hope that all of your dreams and wishes come true in 2011. I would also sincerely like to thank all of my readers for your thoughts, comments, and even criticisms over the past years. They are all welcomed and appreciated. It is nice to know that there are actually people out there who still want to learn. And it's signed 73, Irwin Call, W-A-2-N-D-M. Let's take a look now at public service. An article titled In the Shadow, A Great Surf City Training Experience by Richard Fisher, KI6SN. It's not a pretty scenario, but radio amateurs and public service agencies in Huntington Beach, California recognize the value of simulating it just the same. Utter failure of the city's 800 megahertz and computer-assisted fire dispatch system, essential communications needed to respond to world-renowned Surf City citizens in need. The mid-September emergency drill brought Radio Amateur Civil Emergency Service, that's acronym is RACES, R-A-C-E-S, and Huntington Beach firefighters and police officers side by side for one of an ongoing series of training exercises. Huntington Beach RACES is the primary backup should this unlikely event actually take place, said Steve Graboff, M.D., called W6GOS, RACES Chief Radio Officer. And we train yearly to maintain our skills. We call this training the Shadow Drill. While they are not actually shut down, everyone acted as though these essential 800 megahertz and fire dispatch systems were incommunicado. Our purpose is to provide seamless amateur radio 911 dispatch of the Huntington Beach Fire Department and provide tactical citywide fire communications among all fire stations, fire equipment, and personnel, W6GOS said. Brevin Mettler, KI6FRG, Emergency Services Coordinator for Emergency Management and Homeland Security in Huntington Beach, had high praises for the RACES operator's skill and participation. They know they're important, he said. They're my constant. They're self-sufficient. My RACES people just do. The radio amateurs tried to beat the calls from the 911 Metronet system during the exercise, Mettler said, and they succeeded many times. The elaborate MCOM plan included RACES communicated stationed at Huntington Beach Police Department Communications Center to intercept 911 fire and medical calls and relay those to the Fire Department Operations Center using temporarily set up amateur radio equipment. RACES team members dispatched to each of the 8 city fire stations with enough operators to staff 15 pieces of fire apparatus where an amateur base station was set up, as well as temporary amateur gear on a battalion chief command vehicle, 8 paramedic engines, 2 trucks, 4 emergency transport vehicles, those are fire ambulances, 4 RACES communicators sent to the FDOC to act as net control operators for the 2-meter and 440 megahertz dispatch nets, and auxiliary personnel to assist the fire command staff with visual equipment tracking and availability. The 911 fire and medical calls were sent from the fire department to FDOC via a 440 megahertz backbone net. Graboff said. That information was heard by fire command staff, who then advised what units were to be dispatched. Fire units were then dispatched from FDOCV, a 2-meter tactical net. W6GOS explained that the dispatch is heard by the fire crew from the base station radio set up in that station, or relayed by the RACIS operator if they are out of the station and mobile. And the RACIS operator resumes communications from the fire rig once they are dispatched, using the amateur gear attached to the rig. The 2-meter net maintains unit dispatch confirmations and en route, on scene, completed assignment and availability data, as well as unit to unit and other citywide tactical communications. This year, 26 Huntington Beach RACIS personnel participated in the Shadow Drill, W6GOS said. We had an outstanding drill with solid communications from all locations, and we were able to provide the level of service that Huntington Beach Fire needed to continue normal operations when assuming the actual 800 megahertz failure had occurred. RACIS personnel need to remember that all that they see and hear as part of the fire team is privileged and confidential. No photographs can be taken showing injured people in the field or from within a hospital. It can be difficult to maintain calm and composed during the excitement of the dispatch, he said. Jumping on the fire rig and racing to the call's code 3, radio vigilance must be 100% with immediate response to net control when called, since property and lives are at risk. I'll continue with another public service piece in this article. Nevada FM station to have amateur radio backup. An FM broadcast station slated to serve the Prangat Valley community of Alamo, Nevada, will have an amateur radio element filling a public service need in the area, according to a recent report on Amateur Radio Newsline. FM radio station KQLN, 91.3 FM on the dial, has its tower in place just off Nevada Highway 93 and is expected to cover 50 miles in all directions, according to station owner Harvey Kaplan, KD7FJJ. However, there's more. In a recent interview, Kaplan told the Lincoln County Record newspaper that the station's transmitter site will be home to both KQLN and an amateur radio station that will have coverage over most of the populated area of the valley. The ham station will be battery-powered and charged by a solar power panel. Kaplan notes that amateur radio can get messages through when conventional public safety radio systems fail, or help when such systems may become overloaded. ARN's Don Carlson, KQ6FM, reported, Kaplan says that some messages can be urgent to fire or police, or can simply relay health and welfare information to relatives of those in a disaster area. Either way, says Kaplan, they can be life-saving. Kaplan told the Record that almost everyone associated with the station, called Alamo Radio, is not only a licensed amateur radio operator, but also a member of the Area RACIS team. That's Amateur Radio Emergency Service Team. Jerry Fuge, KC6ILH, Emergency Coordinator in Nevada's northern Nye County, said Kaplan is a member of the region's ARES RACIS organization, which already has a repeater located at another of Kaplan's radio stations. That one is located in the town of Puthrump, a city made famous by coast-to-coast overnight talk show host Art Bell, radio call W60BB. Kaplan added in the newspaper article, he hopes that others will want to serve the community and the valley by becoming licensed radio amateurs, the Amateur Radio Newsline report said. Now, if you as a listener is interested in learning more about KQLN in Nevada, you can go on web to www.kqln.org/. The next article is in the category of digital connection. The author Don Rotolo, call end 2IRZ. Don titles his piece, Phone Apps for Hams. Do hams build things anymore? I know of several companies that sell electronic kits, and electronic parts are probably more readily available now via the internet than ever before. But construction articles are few and far between. I'd write a construction article, but there's nothing I really need to build. Or more accurately, nothing I could build that isn't already available for less than the cost of the parts alone. It seems that just doing it in software is far easier and less costly than almost any other option. An excellent example is the proliferation of sound card radio modes, from PSK31 and AGWPE to WINMOR. Those are all acronyms. Few new digital modes require any kind of hardware aside from a computer, sound card, radio, and radio interface. However, even that is changing. Many of us carry around small portable computers with the capabilities that were science fiction just a dozen years ago. They are equipped with a keyboard, color high-resolution touch screen display, decent audio capabilities, megabyte data rates to the internet via built-in radios, operating systems with brand names, and even make phone calls. Speaking of cell phones, of course. From the latest Android or iPhone to the venerable BlackBerry, cell phones are not only gaining in popularity and computing power, but in capabilities for use as well outside the realm of plain old telephone service. What does a cell phone have to do with ham radio? Ignoring the fact that hams pioneered the technologies behind the whole cellular phone network, several enterprising software developers have written applications. They're called apps, APPS, for smart cell phones that are targeted directly at amateur radio operators. This, I contend, is the home brewing that hams are doing today, and perhaps a valid excuse to get one of those smartphones sooner rather than later. Some of these apps, especially the free ones, admittedly are nothing more than helpers to assist in looking up information that is already out there on the web. As examples of this category, we have Callbook for iPhone, which links to online callbook servers, or the ARRL RSS dashboard widget, which displays the ARRL's ham radio newsfeed. In some cases, it might be easier to get to this info with your mobile browser instead. There are, however, a few apps that are truly unique and, to some of us, valuable. My personal favorite is the free Echolink app, which allows registered Echolink users to connect to the system from anywhere if their iPhone or iPad Touch has a Wi-Fi or 3G has a connection. There is also a version for Android, but unless you have an Android phone to access the Android marketplace, it's not exactly easy to see it or search for it. In an effort to reduce what I see as the pirating of Android apps, they can now only be installed directly through the phone and not downloaded via computer. This has been mostly effective. Let's take a quick tour of a few other cell phone apps that are directed to the radio amateur. Satellite tracking is more than handy. It's a requirement if you expect to make any contacts via the Oscar satellites. Satellite Tracker is a free utility for iPhone, iPad Touch, and iPad that can display the track of satellite passes over your location. KEPS, K-E-P-S, those are Keplerian elements, the data that precisely describes the orbit, are downloaded from the internet, and the phone's GPS system is used to determine your location. You can use your phone to point at the satellite, helping you aim your antenna. You can also download Satellite Tracker Plus for $1.99, which adds, with other features, several useful graphical displays, ground track, signal footprint on the Earth, and a timeline showing the passes of all selected satellites over a given time period. The same developer also published Maidenhead, which displays the Great Circle heading to any other location on Earth. At 99 cents, this could be handy for pointing your beam toward the DX when you're not at home. Foxhunt is another nifty free app that brings the power of the iPhone to bear on the task of locating a target. Point the phone at the target, that's the direction your direction-finding antenna shows, and press a button. Repeat, and Foxhunt shows you on a map where the target is located. Of course, a larger number of directional bearings will deliver greater accuracy. You can even get driving instructions to the target via the iPhone. This requires iPhone 3GS or iPhone 4. My research has uncovered several more apps for iPhones than for Android phones, but this could be a function of the lack of a search feature in the Android marketplace. All of this depends on your getting some kind of smartphone, of course. That 3-year-old standard phone just won't cut it. If you're anything like me, I chafe at not only having to pay for the phone service, but then adding around $30 a month for each phone for a data plan. Although a large portion of my life was successfully survived without having a phone on me at all times, admittedly, my 2-meter rig served some of that purpose. These days, even a stodgiest skinflint might find that a modern smartphone is so darned handy to have around that it easily justifies its cost. I don't work for the phone company. I don't even like the phone company. But just imagine having the whole internet available to you from anywhere. It's a map, dictionary, encyclopedia, phone book, notepad, and so much more. You might actually make your life easier with one. Also, who knows? Maybe you'll write an app, sell a copy to every ham in the United States for 99 cents a pop, and retire to play radio. Such is the state of the home brewing art. Boy, that does sound like an enticing idea, doesn't it? The author concludes with, as is my custom this time of year, I wish you and your family and friends the very best of the holiday season. I hope you enjoy a happy, healthy, and prosperous new year. This time of year seems to cause the whole world to think more about peace, and regardless of your personal, political, and religious beliefs, I think most of us can agree that living in peace and freedom is one of the best ways to live. 73. Don, N2IRZ. Well, folks, there's been a lot of talk about the four new ones in the Caribbean. Late September and into October proved to be an interesting period of time for DXers and contesters, too. Contests such as Scandinavian Activity on CW and Single Sideband, North American Sprint on Single Sideband, CQ Worldwide RTTY, state QSO parties, and more. There were lots of things for everyone. Then there were the DX gatherings in Chicago for the W9DXCC, and a few weeks later in Pigeon Forge, Tennessee, for the W4DXCC/SCDCO event. All were great events, and those who attended thoroughly enjoyed themselves. Now here's some news. You may have heard it on other recordings or not. Ex-Netherland Antilles, new ones. Then the event everyone has been talking about for months now, the new ones created from the former Netherland Antilles as of October 10. I lost track of the number of people who made their way to one or the other of the islands to mark this historic event. Never before had so many new ones come on the air at the same time and from the same general vicinity. In the days leading up to the October 10th, we heard a lot of PJ, prefix stations, that's Papa Juliet, prefix stations on the air from all of the five islands, Bonaire, Curaçao, Saba, St. Eustatius, and St. Martin. Each of the islands had been given a different number for their prefix. Bonaire would be Papa Juliet 4. Curaçao stayed with Papa Juliet 2. Papa Juliet 6 was for Saba, Papa Juliet 5 for St. Eustatius, and Papa Juliet 7 went to St. Martin. Everyone used those prefixes with their home calls prior to the 0400 Zulu on October 10 start time for these new ones. How many DXs were still at their radios at 0400 on October 10? Well, I can tell you from my personal experience that it must have been thousands, and all over the world, too. Some in the United States of America even had a hard time breaking the pileup of Europeans in the early morning hours. There was lots of excitement on the islands, too. St. Martin and the others got sideswiped by Tropical Storm Otto, which later became Hurricane Otto, after turning back into the Atlantic. For San Martin, about 15 to 20 inches of rain fell, creating major problems with roadways, flooding, etc. The PJ7E team had shipped a huge load of equipment, expecting it to arrive in plenty of time for them to set up and be ready for 0400 Zulu. Otto had other plans, however, creating waves of up to 15 feet and closing the harbor on the island. It was Sunday, October 11, before that boat was able to land, and then the team had to wait until Monday morning to get the equipment from the docks to the two separate locations, one for CW and the other for single-sideband talk phone, where they could finally begin to assemble the stations and antennas. In good DXers fashion, a few of the team members had planned ahead and took some equipment as they traveled. The CW location had an ICOM IC7000 and a screwdriver antenna, and the single sideband phone location had an IC706 and wires for 40 and 20 meters, and thus were able to participate in the 0400 activities, even though on a limited basis. I have to comment on IC7000 and screwdriver antenna. That is exactly the same setup I had taken to the Bahamas on April 2009 when I was active as a C6AAA. It worked great for me, and from the signal I heard as I worked the team on CW and RTTY on several bands, it was doing a pretty good job for them as well. The operations from all the islands continued for a number of days, as much as a few weeks for some. It was plenty of time to work as many as you wanted. My advice in the weeks leading up to October 10 was to work every station using a PJ prefix. On October 13th, both CQ and the ARRL announced the new assignment of DX entities in the Caribbean. The old Leeward Islands used to be PJ2/4 and the Windward Islands PJ5/6/7 entities are deleted as of 0400 UTC, Universal Time Constant, October 10, 2010. And four new entities have been added: Curaçao, PJ2, Bonaire, PJ4, St. Eustatius /Saba, PJ5/6, and St. Martin, PJ7. The ARRL says it will begin accepting confirmations from these for awards credit as of January 1, 2011, even though their DXCC status is retroactive to 10-10-10. CQ began accepting confirmations from these new entities for its awards immediately upon making the announcements. You know, folks, with just a few minutes to go, I'm looking at a gift situation for Christmas if you're interested in the book corner. The Insider. Did President John F. Kennedy and Soviet Premier Nikita Khrushchev secretly exchange classified information on space medicine at the height of the Cold War? Ham operator and author Thomas S. Fisk, F-I-S-K-E, his call Alpha Alpha 6 Tango Fox, AA6TF, suggests that they might have in his just-released 10th book, the title, The Insider. The book is cast as a novel, but Fisk says it is a fictionalized account of actual events. Best of all, for us, the book's hero is a ham, required by international politics to hide the name of the real characters. Fisk uses this novel as a device to show how an amateur radio operator and his new wife unravel a mystery surrounding the life of a departed friend, Ted Benson, M.D. In the book, Ted tells the ham, that's Stokely Toles, from his deathbed about his career in the USSR and the U.S. as a space medicine scientist working for NASA, and then, ostensibly, the National Science Foundation, NSF. Fisk explains that there really was a heroic figure like Ted Benson, but that was not his real name, and that he actually worked for two U.S. intelligence agencies. Since conventional wisdom has it that Kennedy and Khrushchev did not agree at the time to swap information on space medicine, Fisk says many so-called experts were caught flat-footed by the supposed late revelations that they did. Also, Fisk tells us that to this day, neither the Russian nor the American government will admit that such an exchange ever took place. In the book, Fisk describes how the ham, Stokely, and his wife, Ari, spent several months seeking information from the federal government under the Freedom of Information Act to get actual dates and methods that were used to keep the entire operation secret from Congress and, of course, the American people, and especially the Russian people. According to the author, a shroud of secrecy still hangs over the project in several countries, even though Stokely and Ari found sources in the United States and the former Soviet Union that had supported Ted's story. Is the story behind the insider fact or fiction? That will be for the reader to decide. Either way, the book makes for a good read, especially if you grew up during the Cold War and the 1960s space race. It's published by Star Publish LLC. For more information, you can contact Tom Fisk at fiskets@msn.com or visit his website at www.fiskfamily.com/Fisk Aesthetics, where he lists and describes his other books. Well, ladies and gentlemen, that brings me up to time for the December 2010 reading and digest format of CQ Magazine here on the Courage Handy Ham system. This is Bob Zeta. My amateur call is N1BLF, November 1, Bravo Lima Foxtrot. If you have any comments, plus or minus, or suggestions or recommendations or constructive criticism, I wouldn't mind hearing from you at all if you have internet capabilities. My internet address is my call sign, n1blf@comcast.net. CQ Magazine is a publication of CQ Communications Incorporated, 25 New Bridge Road, Hicksville, New York, 11801. This recording is a production of the Courage Handy Ham System, 3915 Golden Valley Road, Golden Valley, Minnesota, 55422. It is for the use of eligible Handy Ham members only. Any other use may violate copyright laws. Handy Hams may reach at area 763-520-0512 or at email address handyham@courage.org. Handy Ham is always lowercase and spelled one word, H-A-N-D-I-H-A-M. So, handyham@courage.org. A wonderful website updated all the time, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. It's www.handyham.org. Again, Bob Zeta, N1BLF. From Dartmouth, Massachusetts, I say 73s, happy holidays, and a great new year. Bye-bye.